Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Hear, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast with me, Sian Kane. This week it is prizes upon prizes. The Women's Prize for Fiction, previously known as the Baileys, announced its long list. The Man Booker International Prize for Fiction in Translation announced its 13-book selection. And we've got the winner of the Jalak Prize for Writers of Colour and the Carnegie Kate Greenaway Medal shortlists coming later in the week. And we're not even at the usual Man Booker or the Nobel Prize stages yet. Yes, it may all be marketing, and I might be a little bit jaded by this sea of book gongs, but they do introduce us to new authors, like Imogen Hermes Gower, who was longlisted for the Women's Prize for her first novel, The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock, a tale set in Georgian London about a mermaid that may or may not be real. We have an interview with her shortly. But first, when Claire, Richard and I chatted about the Man Booker International longlist, I perhaps wasn't my usual enthusiastic self.
Sian, I'm going to pick you up for being a bit jaded in your introduction because
jaded already.
On the other hand, opened up this Booker longlist, Man Booker International longlist, and it's like a bag of sweeties. I mean, there are so many fascinating things about it. I'm becoming a real international fiction nerd, I think.
So it happens to us all in the end.
The first thing to say is six women, seven men. Well, it could be seven women, six men, but pretty damn good.
That's pretty good.
Interesting, really interesting range of countries. Taiwan, anyone? I've never read a Taiwanese novel. Have you?
No, not at all. And Iraq as well, which is
nice. Iraq, yeah. The publishers, absolutely fascinating. Only one of the big publishers on it. They appear twice. So there are two of the 13 from the conglomerates, but it's the same publisher. All the rest are indies. And going down to the tiniest indie, Charco Press, who are based in Edinburgh, who they've produced this Argentinian novel by Ariana Harwitz called Die My Love. And it's one of their two launch titles.
That's cool.
And I'm actually very keen on this because I did quite a lot last year at Edinburgh with Samantha Schweblin's Fever Dream, which is another tiny little jewel of an Argentinian novel. I think there's something really interesting going on with Argentinian women writers. However, I have with the caveat that two swallows do not a summer make, necessarily.
Well, you said before there's quite an interesting phenomenon coming on here with fragmentary books.
Yeah, fragment seems to be one of the themes because obviously Die My Love is fragmentary. Han Kang's The White Book, which is her third novel to be published here, is a fragmentary book, which is it's sort of fragments around the loss of her older sister at the age of two, this sort of haunting family tragedy that happened. And then, you know, my absolute heroine, Olga Tokarczuk, who I sort of sing to the rafters all the time, who's Polish, and her novel Flights, although it is not in any way a fragmentary novel, it is about fragments as her narrator. Her narrator is a traveller. In fact, she's the traveller who is addicted to, as she describes it, all things broken, incomplete and peripheral. And that just seems to sum up something in the zeitgeist about this Man Booker list. And I'm really interested about when you find that guiding light. It's a bit like being an aeroplane driving through the dark, being a literary editor or involved with books. And I suddenly think, oh yeah, I've seen that light going through the dark. And that seems to me something that's going on at the moment. And it's a sort of zeitgeist and it's sort of captured by this list.
I'm also very excited to see Laurent Binet on, who's one of the books
I enjoyed. We know you love Laurent Binet. Real boys' book.
That was fun.
Is it a boys' book?
No, it's a sort of French clever boys' book.
so was HHHH, and everyone really liked that.
Yeah, well then, you know, there's something for the boys on the list as well. But no, it's great fun as well, because HHHH was sort of very nervy and serious, and you know, but this is exploring the same kind of issue about whether fiction or reality is kind of, whether you can get to it best through telling stories or through facts, but it's doing it with a kind of fun face on. It's like a kind of party animal book. It's great.
And you're also a fan of Javier Cercas, aren't
Yes,
you?
I've not read this latest one, but it's another one, again, where he's investigating the truth and fiction divide. This is about Enric Marco, who is somebody I'd not heard of at all, but he was the president of the Mauthausen Survivors Association in Spain until 2005, when it was revealed that he was never in that concentration camp. Mm. And so Cercas is doing one of his usual kind of investigations about why someone would tell such a massive lie and what it means to be such a massive storyteller on such an awful subject as well.
There's also, the Antonio Munoz Molina book, who's a Spanish author as well. His book's all about, his novel is all about the assassination of Martin Luther King. And so he's looking at something that's very real, but also bringing in things from his own life. So it's that kind of weird balance of what is truth and what is not. I'm sort of thinking of Han Keng's The White Book as well, that sort of blending of biography and fiction.
Yeah, well, if we're going down that line, then Gabriela Ibarra's The Dinner Guest, which is based on the murder of her grandfather by Basque separatists in the 1970s. And again, it's a sort of almost like a detective story created around a family reality, something very haunting.
That's the one I'm excited about. It's the debut, and
it's not fragmentary.
No.
But you could look at it. No, I get very nerdy about translators, because this is a prize which is 50-50 divided by translators and writers. And Frank Wynne, he's on translator twice.
Yeah. Two different languages.
In two different languages.
That's so cool.
How cool is that? He's Irish. He went to live. He sold books in Paris for a while. He now lives in London. And he is, among other things, is Welbeck's translator. So he's there with Javier Cercas, and also with the other one, with Virginie Despentes. Now Sean, are far too young to know about Virginie Despentes.
No, educate me. Come on.
Back in the day, she wrote this novel called Baise-moi, which became the first French novel to be banned in 28 years. And then she made the movie of it, and the posters were so shocking that London Underground banned the
Are we translating Baise-moi for our non-French-speaking listeners?
Yeah, it was because they felt it might offend, they felt it might offend French tourists, as indeed it might have done.
So you have to go home and Google what Baise-moi means.
No, we can say it. We're allowed. Go for it.
Come on, Claire.
I would never. I don't think it needs to be said. And so that was her debut in 1994, and the film was in 2002.
So what was on the poster?
Well, what you can imagine. But
Well,
the words, apart from anything else. I mean, it's about the sort of most shocking thing you could put on a poster in an underground. I mean, in 2002, for goodness sake, we were only just into the new millennium.
We didn't do those
children.
Things back then.
Outrageous behaviour.
But this one, she was a punk. And she was actually, she has a really fabulous past. She was also a massage parlour hostess, read that as you may. Mm. And this one is about, goes back to her sort of punk days. It's a sort of picaresque about sex, drugs and 90s punk rock, following an out-of-business record shop owner.
Yeah, well, the detail I liked about that is basically this record shop owner goes out of business, loses everything, loses his home, and he also loses access to the internet. And before this all happens, he puts something on Facebook, which is very controversial and angers a lot of people. But because he's homeless now and because he doesn't have access to the internet, he's completely unaware of it all. So he's sort of wandering Paris and doesn't really know what everyone's talking about around him. It sounds quite cool. I had her described to me as the French Kathy Acker, which quite appeals.
Or the feminist Welbeck, actually. Yeah. I think you could describe her as. Yeah, yeah. Mm. She's sort of down and dirty, but she's one hell of a dame. Anyway, so yes, I'm really excited about this list, and I will be reading most of them, except I'm not sure I'll be reading Laurent Binet, Richard. I'll leave that
what
to you.
What have you got against Laurent Binet?
Too much fun.
Oh, another one is that we haven't mentioned is Jenny Erpenbeck. My money's on Jenny Erpenbeck, because
really?
I think this is a novel of real moral stature. And it's about, Jenny is from East Germany, was an East German, from a Berliner. And it's about a retired academic investigating the lives of 10 African asylum seekers that he happens across. So it's absolutely a story of our times. And it's about the possibility of developing, maintaining and developing empathy for these others that have suddenly come into our community. So, yeah, she's my bet. How about you?
Well, I don't know, but I'd be delighted if it was Monsieur Binet.
Just to spite Claire.
No, just, again, partly because it's a victory for fun.
Well, I've been told to put my money on your mate Olga.
Oh, yeah, well, Olga, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just only trying to make it work for Olga by voting for someone else.
I'll put my vote for Olga then.
So the one person, that, in fact, the two people we don't think it'll be is Han Kang or Laszlo Krasznahorkai, both of whom are previous winners with more substantial books. Is that not the case? So the Vegetarian was a really substantial book with which she took the first prize of this in its new incarnation, i.e. for a single book rather than for a lifetime's work. Laszlo won the last prize in the old configuration of the prize, which was for a lifetime's work. And they're both really, really significant writers.
Well,
but actually, the other thing is that it's a bit of a bummer for Laszlo's translators because there are three of them, so they're not going to get so much money.
If they have to share their 25 grand. I mean, that's interesting that you talk about these books being less substantial for both of them, because both of them, we're talking about fragmentary books before, both of them are, because the Krasznahorkai book is 21 stories all told by a narrator, which kind of reminds me of the Man Booker a few years ago when everyone got funny about David Shaloy being on the Man Booker shortlist because was it a novel or was it short stories? And we seem to have just kind of gotten over that now.
Yeah, no, but this prize specifically allows short stories and novels is one of the reasons why I think it's a really good prize. You know, I think it's sort of very elegantly leapt over some of the problems that hobble its big sister, the Booker, and that's very pleasing. And the other is that, you know, it genuinely does open up a world that one hasn't read. Even people like us who sit cowering under mountains of books all the time, there are sort of books here that I just haven't seen, and that's always exciting.
Always a surprise. Well, you talk about the Man Booker International being the little sister of the Booker, but now we've got their wonderful aunt, the Women's Prize for Fiction, and we've got the long list for that as well. There's some great books on it this year. I'm really pleased with the combination.
I just feel it's a little bit last year, and I just think that's an accident of calendar. But there are sort of books like, I was really excited about Carmilla Shamsie last year, really excited about Nicola Barker's Happy.
Well, I mean, you have Fiona Moseley's Elmet, another one, which is...
It was on the Booker last year.
And as
was Camilla as well.
Yeah.
And Arundhati Roy, she was on the Booker as well.
Yeah.
So it does feel like that there's some stuff that it feels a bit late to the party almost.
Yeah.
But then there's other things like Happy, which Nicola Barker's book, which didn't really get much mainstream support from prizes. It did get nominated for the Goldsmiths, which rewards experimental fiction. So it's kind of nice to see it up for a mainstream award.
So it's already been acknowledged by another prize. But the really nice thing about that is looking down, you know, there are a lot of first novels here. And Nicola Barker is the senior novelist on this list.
Yeah.
This is her 12th novel. And
wow.
She is the most innovative of everyone on this list, I think. I'd be very interested if any listeners would argue with that, in which case go and put your arguments on our podcast page. I mean, she's this amazing figure who continues to do her own thing. Another writer like that, although a very different sort of writer, is Rachel Seifert, who's A Boy in Winter, got very little attention last year, and it's a sort of fable of two Jewish brothers in the Second World War who run away when their parents are rounded up by the Nazis and disappear into the Ukrainian countryside with a Ukrainian peasant. And I encountered her because I interviewed her at the Edinburgh Festival, and I have been completely haunted by this book, and I have given it to several people. I think she's a really significant writer. And it's, you know, this is a time with this prize that this huge, long, I would argue in some ways, over long list, 16 books. I ask you for 16 books. But it does give you a chance to note people who are continuing on their own track.
It's partly because publishers aim so much of their big hitters towards the eligibility criterion for the Booker. This does have a bit of a kind of sweep-up, a catch-up kind of feel to it.
Mm.
One of the debuts that is on it is The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock, Imogen Hermes Gower, which is actually published earlier this year, so it feels also very comparatively fresh.
And we'll be hearing from Imogen in a moment. She came in to talk about her novel, The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock. But the book I'm really excited about on this long list, and I hope it remains on the shortlist, is Mina Kandasamy's When I Hit You. Or A Portrait of the Writer as a Young Wife, which is a very elegant title, I think.
And this is actually also on the, is it the Jalak Prize?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And now, I came across her through The Gypsy Goddess, her first novel. She's a poet as well. And she is a really fiery polemicist. And the Gypsy Goddess is slightly similar to Han Kang's Human Acts, for those who know it, in that it's dealing with a massacre. And there is a point in the massacre when it beggars, it goes beyond the capacities of the humanist form that is the novel. And so in the central scene of it, she ends up listing the labels on the remains of a pile of corpses, and all it says is something like child two, you know, boy five, mother, you know, woman such and such. And so and I just thought her exploration of the limits of narrative within horror situations is sort of something other, and here she's dealing with domestic abuse. I haven't actually read it yet. It's on my pile. And I definitely will read it because I am a fan.
So who do you think will win the Women's Prize for Fiction?
Oh, that's a big one, isn't it? Oh, God, I don't know.
One in 16 chance to get it right.
Well, I'm always wrong. And I always end up not wanting to jinx the person I really love. My hunch is it might be someone like Jennifer Egan,
yeah.
Manhattan Beach. I mean, Jennifer Egan has been at the top of her game for a while now. Manhattan Beach is significantly different to Visit from the Goon Squad. She's still developing, so it is interesting. It's not just like more of the same. Yeah, there you go.
That's your pick.
But, you know, if you were to say where my heart goes, it might be a different choice.
Yeah. I'd quite like to see Nicola Barker win for Happy, just because of how experimental it is.
Look at the judges. If you look at the judges, I mean, that's what you always have to do with these prizes. Sarah Sands, who's and Anita Nand, who are both sort of big-name broadcasters. Katie Brand, who's a comedian. Catherine Mayer, who's the co-founder of the Women's Equality Party, and Imogen Stubbs, who's an actress. I don't think it's going to go to an experimental novel. I'm sorry. You know, I absolutely don't mean to disparage them particularly. I just don't think that they are likely to be a particularly nerdy panel. And there are a lot of different ways to read fiction, and I think that you have to be a bit of a nerd to like Nicola Barker.
Well, this nerdy panel of one, we'll continue to back Nicola.
What about you, Richard? Do you have a view?
Again, I find it very difficult to pick a name out at this stage, partly, as you say, because you want you know, the things that you enjoy to do well, but you're never quite sure whether people are going to agree with you on that. I'd like to see Kamala Shamsi do well. I think she's a great writer.
It's another book of moral stature, yeah. Isn't it? And yeah. And God, we need them.
Imogen Ermers-Gower is one of the six debut authors longlisted for this year's Women's Prize. Her novel, The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock, follows the story of Jonah Hancock, a merchant in 18th century London who makes a fortune touring a freak show imitation of a mermaid, a fetus melded together with a fishy tail. His success attracts the attentions of Angelica, a courtesan, who marries the merchant and embarks on a new life of respectability as Mrs. Hancock. But what she doesn't realise is her husband is hiding a secret, a certain sea creature in a grotto at the back of the garden. When she joined Richard in the studio, Imogen began with a reading.
On my voyages, says Captain Jones, I have seen many strange things, things that you cannot begin to imagine, ladies. I have seen cows with necks as tall as trees. I have seen ordinary-sized Chinese women with feet no bigger than hot cross buns. And I have... Out with it, Mr. Hancock interrupts. Is it in the bag? Asks Suki. You are a young lady of striking perspicacity. Captain Jones observes the faces of his audience and sighs. Very well. Let us get this over with. Perhaps once you see the marvel I have brought to you, you will be more enthusiastic. Captain Jones eases the canvas away, and at first they cannot think what it is they see. For it is brown and wizened, like an apple forgotten at the bottom of the barrel, or like the long-dead rats Mr. Hancock once found bricked up in the kitchen wall, parched and cured by the elements, skin that cracked under the pressure of a thumb. It's the size of an infant, and like an infant, its ribcage is delicate and pathetic beneath its parchment skin, and its head is large, and its fists are drawn up to its face. But this is as far as the comparison may be extended. For no infant has such fearful claws, and no infant such a snarl with such sharp fangs in it, and no infant's torso ends in the tail of a fish. I bought it from a Dutchman I met in Macau, says Tyso Jones, and he from some Japanese fishermen who captured it alive. I'm sorry it has not survived. A vicious thing, says Suki. You don't know that. I know how it looks. By the time she goes to her bed tonight, she will have forgotten that it is dead. In her imagination, it already quivers with rage, clawing to escape a fishbowl, lashing the water in the face of its impotence. As surely as if she had seen it with her own eyes, she knows that the water around Java teems with thousands of little creatures just like it. She hears their hoarse cries and feels their fury. "It can't harm you now," says Captain Jones, but she stares at him. He spreads his hands. "Didn't I bring it all the way across the ocean? And it did not sink me, as they say mermaids do, and it did not bite me, as I know that apes do." He chuckles, but she is not reassured. "Come closer, you must take a better look." They crowd in. There is a little squeak in the girl's breathing. They want to peer at it, inspect it, but at the same time they cannot but recoil. It is so perfectly dead. "I don't see a single stitch on it," says Mr. Hancock at length. "No glue, no paint. How is it done?" "Done? You think it's done?" Captain Jones is aggrieved. "Like a conjuring trick. No, this is not done, it simply is. If it were done by any hand, 'twere God's alone." He warms to his theme. "After all the trouble I've taken, after I cross half the earth twice, which is in a practical sense the entirety of the earth, when, sir, have I ever brought you counterfeit?" "No, never, never, of course not. But you must appreciate that a mermaid..." "Well, it's quite impossible." "Not so much as a blade of grass in all the tea I've ever borne safely to your warehouse," Captain Jones laments. "No, no, no, I did not mean to imply..." "This is not a toy," says Captain Jones. "This is not a bauble. You cannot buy it at a fair. This is a genuine mermaid."
So first of all, congratulations. What's it like to be on the Women's Prize for Fiction longlist?
It is wonderful. I didn't expect it at all. I wasn't even watching the list.
How'd you find out?
Well, actually, it's really funny. This time last year, I was awake at midnight and I was watching the Women's Prize list, and one of my friends, Ayobami Adebayo, was on it, and I sent her this like really hysterical message being like, "Oh my God," and she didn't wake up till the morning and find out.
Full of messages.
Yeah, yeah, this year she did the same to me. She was the first person to send me a message saying, "Ah," and I didn't look at it until the morning. So yeah, it was just waking up in the morning for these millions of messages, which was very nice.
Phone buzzing with success.
Yeah.
Hooray.
Yeah, for once, thank goodness.
So take us back to the beginning. How did you get started on this tale of a mermaid adrift in 18th century London?
Well, I had been interested in 18th century women for a long time, in that kind of period of the 1780s.
Women in particular?
Yeah, I think I've always been more interested in women in history than in men. Not necessarily because men are less interesting, but I think it's hard maybe to get a handhold in something that's so established and concrete and official.
We've just heard more about them, so...
Yeah, there are a few male characters who I'm very fond of in The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock, but I was more interested when I was writing the novel in kind of how women exist in the space in quite a masculine world. That was my real interest, and I think that's always been my interest in women's history, is this kind of... often but not always domestic space that's rarely kind of documented by official history. And there's space to play, and there's kind of interest in finding out about these people who are maybe not famous but who led interesting lives.
Or interesting in a way that textbook history, school books, learning hasn't really considered before.
Yeah, I remember kind of as a teenager being very frustrated that I wanted to read history books that kind of looked at the texture of everyday life, of how, what your routine would be, what kind of clothes do you wear, how do you think about the tasks that you do every day. I was always very frustrated when I was young that history books are very kind of like grand sweep.
This person invaded this country.
Yeah, exactly. And there's, you know, the big historical themes about how people then feel politically, and this, you know, knock-on effect that one historical act has on another. But you don't really see that kind of everyday life, how this builds up for real people. That was always my interest.
A very kind of novelistic take on the past.
Yeah, I suppose so. I think that I've always been interested in history, very interested in history. But I think in hindsight, I probably have always brought quite a novelistic approach to it, that I've really wanted to maybe empathise, to understand how people lived in particular places.
What it feels like from the inside.
Yeah, exactly.
Very much
yeah.
The territory of the novel, it seems to me.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, so you wanted to, you had this pre-existing interest in how women lived in the 18th century. And So how did this turn into a story?
So I was always very interested in the women. I never thought about writing fiction set during this period. It was just kind of something that I read, or I guess as a hobby, out of interest. And it wasn't until I was working at the British Museum And I had started to write in earnest for the first time as an adult, that I'd kind of started to make it a serious part of my life again. I'd always been an enthusiastic writer as a child, but it was, you know, the kind of thing you put on the back burner. So while I was at the British Museum, I started challenging myself to look at the objects that I was working around and pick one out and try and make a story around it.
It was a kind of prompt.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes it would be very direct. It would be like, this object is in this scene. And sometimes I would be thinking about kind of a step further, like the person who might have owned this, what their priorities were, what kind of situation their life might have been, that this object is not directly part of the story, but it suggests a moment to me. And that would be, these would be very small pieces of writing, like maybe 600, 700 words maximum, just little moments to challenge myself. And they weren't really supposed to go anywhere. But one of the objects in the British Museum is a mermaid, just like Mr. Hancock's mermaid.
Fiji mermaid.
Yes, it's a Fiji mermaid, which was, as Mr. Hancock's is, it was made in Japan. It was probably brought to Europe via the Dutch merchants who were allowed to go into Japan during this period, and would have quite possibly been assumed to be real. And these things, they do exist in quite a lot of museums still in this country. So there's one in Buxton, I know. There's one at the Horniman Museum. And kind of, I think many regional museums, you may find one of these Fiji mermaids.
And they're all small and wrinkly and...
Yeah, I think there's something... It's their unpleasantness that's their power, I think, that they don't look like, you know, beautiful, sexy woman mermaid, because I think that would actually be quite a hard ask. But the fact that they look so different and kind of repellent is, I think, what makes them still quite captivating. That still nowadays, when I would watch people in the museum, they would kind of look and then look again. There was a fascination there. So I was looking at this mermaid, wondering...
You were standing there in the museum, looking at it.
Yes, I was standing in the museum in my uniform, looking at this mermaid, thinking, who would have owned this? Why did he want it? What would he have thought about it? And I was thinking, I'll write a short story about it. And very immediately, I had these two characters in my mind, Mr. Hancock and Angelica Neal. And I understood the setup between them. And it was, yes, it never kind of wavered from that. They were always going to be the two people in my story. I could have set it, I think, anywhere from about, I would say, from the Restoration to the Regency. So maybe like, you know, 1660s through to maybe the 1830s, because there were definitely still these mermaids arriving in London in the 1820s. But the period that I felt comfortable in that made sense to me was the 1780s, that I had a very clear sense of the voice of the period and the humour of it. I felt at home there. And I could understand what a mermaid like this might have meant during the 1780s, and especially how it might have spoken to women during the period.
Because Mr. Hancock and Angelica Neal, they're two very different characters, mm-hmm. who interact very differently with this point. Was this confrontation, this transformation, something you had in your mind from the start?
Definitely. So I was initially writing a short story, and I'd imagined that this mermaid would be the thing that brought them together and... I can't think what the word is, whether it would be like a kind of mediator between their two visions of the world, and certainly have something to do with the way that Mr. Hancock and other men like him might have seen women like Angelica Neal as something.
Because we should probably say that Mr. Hancock is a Deptford merchant.
He's a
trader in things, in commodities. And Angelica Neal is also a trader, but a very different sort.
Yes. So Angelica Neal is a courtesan. So by the 18th century definition of the word, she is not a mercenary. She's not a person who just has sex with men for money. What she will do is hope that she has one keeper who will pay her way, who she is essentially a mistress to. That it's not kind of, you know, laying your notes down on the bedside table after you're done. It's like you have a long relationship with one person who's consistently able to pay your bills.
But it's nevertheless transactional in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and a lot of the transaction between women and these kind of high-class men who kept them was the women's, I suppose, their beauty, their celebrity, their cachet, as almost as a desirable object. The way that men might want to own other curiosities is exactly the way that they would acquire mistresses from this demimonde, that they needed a particular social cachet to them.
Because that's one of the ways in which the novel, though it's very much of the period, feels very modern. Because, I mean, it's a very kind of cash-driven exchange. I mean, even Angelica Neal even thinks of marriage as a transactional arrangement, but one with an extremely good contract.
Yes, and I was quite interested reading kind of contemporary texts from the 18th century, how many people were already thinking about marriage in these terms.
So that wasn't something that you, as it were, had already in mind and that you've put onto the period? That was already there?
No, I thought it was extraordinary. I would say nowadays we think of Mary Wollstonecraft and her publishing Vindication of the Rights of Women in the 1790s as a really decisive intellectual moment of the first time that you verbalise why are women being held back, what does the transaction of marriage hold for them. But actually these ideas and ones like them were being discussed many decades previously, that she's a very important cultural moment, and it's important also that a woman is able to verbalise this and model perhaps another lifestyle. But she was certainly not the first person to identify or to say it. The Fielding brothers, Henry and John, were both using terms like legalised prostitution in the 1740s. And particularly John Fielding, who was a magistrate, knew a lot about sex work and these kept mistresses because he dealt with them every day, that he was very conscious about the transactional nature of marriage for women and this kind of economic structure that either keeps women safe or shuts them out. Either way, they need to find a place in it.
Because this seems to be the only choice for the women in the novel, is that either you find yourself marriage and respectability, or you're selling yourself at some level.
Yes, exactly. That someone like Mary Wollstonecraft, who was kind of trying to have it both ways, she wanted to remain respectable and also have lovers who she wasn't married to or financially dependent on. That was kind of the outrage that I think up until that point, and obviously beyond, women needed to fit into the system as it was, one way or another. That there was no space for them to make an independent life for themselves.
Because they couldn't earn money any other way.
Exactly, yes. So as a woman, you cannot become an apprentice like a man can. You don't have this skilled work available to you as other men would. And you're so controlled by your situation, kind of dependent on the men who are keeping you, that it's very unlikely, say, you'd be able to just pick yourself up and go and look for work when you're not getting it. The work that women are doing in London is all domestic, so they will be maids, or they will take in laundry or do embroidery and sewing, this kind of thing, which is unstable and unreliable. And there is a statistic that's thrown around that in London during the 18th century, 1 in 5 women was a sex worker. I think it overlooks the fact that lots of women dipped in and out of it, that there were not, you know, tens of thousands of women permanently on London streets, permanently only making their money through sex work. It was something that was always possible to fall back on because it's the only thing that women have. You know, if your husband dies or he leaves you or whatever work you have dries up, that's the one thing that you can reliably fall back on. And I think it seems to be this is the thing that so many 18th century women kind of found their way into sex work because they'd been let down by other situations. And Angelica Neal is certainly no exception, that she has come to London initially as a teenager, as a maid, and has found her way into this demi-monde because it works for her and it's reliable and there is a level of security there that she cannot guarantee for herself anywhere else.
Are there dangers, though, given that awful, appalling situation, are there dangers in having a central character for whom the small disappointment or boredom or terror that she experienced during sex is more than eclipsed by all the attendant enjoyments of the profession?
Absolutely. I think I was very aware while I was writing it that my feeling about sexual autonomy and bodily autonomy are very different from a woman in the 18th century. That I don't feel that what I have laid out in the novel is something I think is correct, but I think it was a fact for a lot of people. That I think nowadays it's absolutely right that we as women are saying it's not okay for us to be, you know, heckled in the street, or for people that we work with to touch us, or that we feel threatened if we don't respond to a man's attention. I think most women nowadays at one point or other in their lives have felt that they have to placate a man or play nice in order to keep themselves safe in a situation that might be sexual and that they don't want. I think there are very few women who've never had to do that. And I see the behaviour of these 18th century women as maybe also just a kind of larger scale, culturally ingrained behaviour of this. It's playing nice. It's placating men and pleasing them because they're the ones who have all the power, and there's huge danger in sexually rejecting someone.
So is Angelica just fooling herself when she tries to say that actually what she's doing is okay?
I think given the situation, it is okay. I think given the options that she has and the possibilities of freedom that any woman during this period has, makes becoming a mistress or a sex worker a far more acceptable choice. That there is so little agency in any of the roles possible to women, that liberties are always going to be taken with their time and their affection and their attention and their bodies, that this is just another form of it. That was my understanding while I was writing the book and seeing the absolute hypocrisy of 18th century society, of when is women's sexual behaviour seen as acceptable and when are they cast out for it? It's so dictated by the men who keep them, whether they're their husbands or their lovers. There is no real freedom, and therefore I don't feel like Angelica is living an absolute lie. She's choosing an option from a range of quite duff options.
And this is the least worst for her in her present situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And she, like other kind of courtesans and mistresses from her period, has seen women who do play by the rules come off badly. So I know that Mary Robinson's mother, Mary Robinson, was an actress in the 1780s. She eventually had a relationship for a while with the Prince of Wales. Her mother had been abandoned by her father, and she tried to bring the children up on her own. One of the ways that she started trying to make money was by setting up a school and putting her name on the front of it. It was Mrs. Darby. When her husband came home and found that she'd been distributing these flyers for her school, he ordered her, he'd been away in Canada, he had another family by this point, he ordered her to close this school down because it was embarrassing for him. That it was embarrassing that she was making it public that he wasn't supporting her. And the shame that this brought on their family outweighed the shame that he wasn't looking after her. It was the effect on him that was the problem,
rather than the public persona.
Yeah, exactly.
Rather than the actual misery.
Rather than the state that she's being forced to bring up their children in. That kind of hypocrisy on an everyday level made it really understandable why their daughter would then really not seek to support herself in that kind of way, knowing how fragile it is, that she would use her a physical attractiveness to keep herself safe, because that's one thing that you as a woman are allowed to do.
You said that there was a wide range of eras when you could have sent this, but this was the era in which you felt most comfortable. How did you go about getting into the period, getting the props, the language, the scenery?
So I kind of had some of it already because I was so interested in the period. There were things that I already liked, and there were turns of phrase I already liked, and I knew how to start getting in. When I started researching in earnest, I was in the British Library a lot. I read a huge amount, a lot of academic texts and also texts that were contemporary with the period. I was very interested in architecture of the period. That was something that really got me in, kind of vernacular small building architecture of London.
Picturing yourself in the rooms.
Yeah, kind of in the rooms and understanding how people used the spaces that they lived in, how they thought of it, especially the idea that in somewhere like Deptford, people did not have large houses. According to probate inventory, they might be living in a three-room house, but they would still have books in there. They would still have, a good bookshelf of classics, and they would have prints, and they would have maybe a porcelain tea set and a good tin of tea.
So stuffed full of things.
Yeah, that they, even though they were not materially wealthy or had particular social class, they wanted those items. They wanted objects, and they felt that they were entitled to that kind of luxury. That, to me, was very interesting. I also read a lot of court transcripts. There's some enterprising man from about the 1770s onwards who would go into court and transcribe all of the trials as they went on. And he would print them in this kind of like public interest kind of way, and then have a trailer at the end of it saying, next edition, the maid who murdered her baby, the man who absconded from his wife and all this stuff. And it's it's a bit Jeremy Kyle, but it's this incredible resource for, because he's transcribing it from the court, you see people's real turns of phrase and their real responses to questions, that these are actual humans who were living 250 years ago. Yeah, just the way they speak and the particular words that they used. I had a phrase book all the time. Whenever I came across something that I liked, I would put it down in my phrase book for, you know, future consideration. And I walked around London a lot. I tried to go to all the places that I'd read about, and I tried to understand them from that physical level.
Although without the houses, the fields, orchards and...
Yeah, that's what I really enjoyed, that actually, looking at old maps and seeing how much is, like, you know, market gardens and fields and little drawings of cows, you know, where there are tower blocks and things now. That was really fun, trying to reimagine the geography of London and how you navigate it then as you wouldn't have now. You know, like how important the river was to it, how we don't have Trafalgar Square or Regent Street to navigate by. It being just a very slightly different city with different focal points in it and really trying to understand it from that sense.
And having made your home there in the end of the 18th century, will you be returning with your next project?
Not with the next project. I feel that with this novel, I set out to do a very particular thing in my relationship with the 18th century and its language and its people and its thoughts. And I think I've done that thing. If I return to it, it will be because there's something new to say and explore. I have some different questions. But I think for the next book, absolutely not another 18th century one. But that's not to rule it out forever.
That was Imogen Hermes Gower, and The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock is published by Harville Secker. Next week. It's always an event when a Jim Crace novel comes out, particularly because often he says it's his last. But fortunately, he's back with The Melody, an ecological fable for our times. Meanwhile, there are thousands of podcasts in the Guardian archive on politics, science, technology, global development, and more. You can find them all at theguardian.com/podcasts. But for now, from me, Sian Kane, and our producer, Susanna Trezillian, goodbye. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.